Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, May 1st. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years, BoydenandPerrin.com. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Scott Rogge of Southwestern Vermont Healthcare. He's here to answer your questions about cardiology, heart health, and related topics. We get a lot of calls, so get on the phone, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Rogge, your calls, much more. When is this coming up, I tell you? It's all coming up on the Vox Pop, right after this news. Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining on this today, on this Medical Monday to discuss heart health is Dr. Scott Rogge, Medical Director of Cardiology at Southwestern Vermont Healthcare. He's board certified in internal medicine. Dr. Rogge graduated from McGill University in Montreal, received his medical degree from St. George's School of Medicine in Granada. Dr. Rogge, welcome back and welcome to, I should say, to the Medical Monday.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here because everybody has a heart. Well, most of us do. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're going to get a lot of calls. We already have a lot of calls. Five people on the line, so if you want to get in and get online, it'll go quickly. Let's go to our usual first guest, Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, what do you got?
What's the current thinking on the use of cardioglycosides such as digitalis?
Jim, that's a good question. Digitalis has been around for a long, long time, one of our oldest medications, also called digoxin. It's derived from foxglove, the plant that sometime you could find in your different gardens. It's used for atrial fibrillation and heart failure. And recent studies, digitalis has really fallen out of favor somewhat. There's risk to using it. I think the take-home point is if you're on that medicine or your doctor's going to prescribe it, you do need to monitor it. You need to check levels. I think if the levels are in an appropriate range, it's still a reasonable medicine for heart failure and for atrial fibrillation. But we're definitely using it much less than we have in the past.
And we have a digitalis plant in our garden. What happens if you eat it?
It could have problems. Overdoing it.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you very much. All right. We'll go to Maria in Salisbury. Okay, Maria, your turn.
Yes, I've had a heart murmur most of my life, and last year had an echocardiograph and was told that eventually I'll probably have to need a valve replacement. What determines that? And also, does it make a difference who reads the results of your electro or your echocardiograph? Mine was read by a doctor of internal medicine. Would a cardiologist see or not see something different with the results? Thank you.
Maria, I'm not going to comment on who should read it specifically. Usually it is a cardiologist. But whoever's reading it, I'm sure, has specific training in echocardiography. So to get to your question, really, I was taught you should do procedures for two reasons. One, to live longer, or one, to feel better. So to replace a heart valve, there's indications where if you're feeling poorly, if you have, again, shortness of breath, chest pain, things like that, could be an indication that you need the valve replaced. But there's also indications you need to fix it just for longevity. So there's certain valves like the mitral valve, which can be leaky and you wouldn't really feel anything. But if the heart starts to enlarge, you really need to replace the valve or fix the valve before the heart's enlarged, or else the cat's out of the bag, so to speak. So that needs to be monitored. So symptoms, and there's specific criteria for replacing the valves by echocardiographic criteria. that we measure.
Have we come a long way with the replacements now? I mean, you know, 20 years ago, it was hot stuff, really, very, very rare. But now I've been hearing a lot more about it.
Yeah. So I would say in the last 10 years, the biggest innovation is something called TAVR, which is a transaortic valve replacement of the aortic valve, which means you don't need your chest opened. So that can all be done percutaneously through the leg. The data seems to be very good. It used to be only for critical patients who couldn't handle a regular valve surgery. Now it's being done on people who are less sick. The longevity of the valve seems to be similar to if you have an open procedure, but that's been a huge innovation for cardiology and cardiac surgery, is replacing the valves without having to open your
chest. Does a heart murmur ever go away?
As a child, sometimes the heart murmur will go away. Once you're an adult, usually it would not go away unless something was done with the valve. Now, the murmurs can sound louder or softer based on your blood pressure and different things like that. But once you're an adult, the murmur would usually not disappear.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Linda in Corinth. Okay, Linda, you're on.
Hello, doctors.
Hey.
I'm calling to ask the procedure for restarting my heart. The problem is I have atrial fibrillation, and one of the doctors wants to shock the heart into its normal rhythm so they can use that as a baseline. So my question is, do they look inside the heart to see if there's any clots or anything before they do that procedure, or isn't that necessary?
That's also a very good question. So typically, this procedure is called an electrical cardioversion. So
Okay. What
is done is you're sedated. You're given an intravenous medication, so you're sedated. It sounds barbaric, but when you're sedated, it's actually a fairly simple procedure we do routinely. So they will put pads or paddles on your chest, and once you're adequately sedated, there's literally a shock that resets the rhythm back to normal. So the thing we do fear with AFib is clots. If you've been on blood thinning medications for a month or so, adequately thinned blood, then you may not need any test to look for any clots. So then we would just do the cardioversion. Sometimes people need it more emergently, and we do a transesophageal echo, which is an ultrasound that you swallow, and we can look and see if there's any clots in the heart before the procedure. But if you've been on the blood thinners an adequate length of time, you shouldn't need that before the cardioversion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Good call. 1-800-348-2551. Now we'll go to Roberta in Saratoga Springs. Okay. Roberta, you go.
Good afternoon, doctors. I was diagnosed about 8 years ago by a cardiologist as having congestive heart failure. He treated me for 2 years and then retired, referred me to his protege, also a cardiologist, who continued to treat me for heart failure for about 2 years. And then about the third or fourth year, he said, I don't have congestive heart failure anymore. Then I moved, and I'm seeing a different cardiologist who treated me for 2 years for heart failure, and now he told me just today, I don't have heart failure anymore. I mean, what do I have? Does heart failure, can it go away?
It can come and go. You can have evidence for heart failure. Would usually be the heart isn't adequately pumping the fluid around, so your legs would be swollen, more short of breath, you're retaining fluids in some way. So you can go in and out of heart failure and not have the fluid retention. So there's two types of heart failure. There's systolic heart failure, which means the heart muscle is weakened and literally isn't able to pump the blood around adequately. And then there's diastolic heart failure, which means your heart muscle is totally strong, but it's more a relaxation issue. The heart doesn't relax and the fluid backs up that way. I would say from what you describe, it's probably more a diastolic issue where the heart isn't relaxing. And that can come and go as far as whether you're holding on to fluids. Typically, you would still be on some medication for that. And you do need to continue to monitor for fluid overload and things like that.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks, Roberta. You too. Okay, we'll go to Lou in Altamont. All right. Lou in Altamont, you're on.
Hello. I had a stent put in my right coronary artery just prior to having my aortic valve replaced with a bioprosthetic valve. My question is, I also have what is perceived as gout, and then after having that diagnosis of gout for roughly two years, I also came down with psoriasis, leading to the possibility of psoriatic arthritis. How do those affect the cholesterol blockages and so forth in the blood system, circulatory system?
Psoriasis itself wouldn't really affect your cholesterol per se, but psoriasis and any type of chronic inflammation can affect atherosclerosis, because that is part of atherosclerosis, is not only cholesterol, but it's hypertension, it's inflammation. Sometimes we check C-reactive protein, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, which is a measurement of inflammation, because we do think that's part of the process of developing atherosclerosis. One thing we frequently get asked, people who are taking stents are on some type of blood thinners, you're on aspirin or Plavix, and then people with arthritis want to take ibuprofen or other medicines for their arthritis. So we get nervous about that, because all those anti-inflammatory medicines can thin your blood. You're already on some blood thinners. So that's one issue to be aware of. But psoriasis itself shouldn't really affect your cholesterol, but can increase just the inflammatory process in general.
Hey, Lou, got to let you go.
Is there anything that can be done for the inflammatory issues other than what I'm doing already, which is the Plavix and the baby aspirin?
Well, we do think statins in general lowers inflammation, and that's some of the benefit for not so much for psoriatic arthritis, but atherosclerosis in general. We think statins lower inflammation and lower your cholesterol. So some of the benefit from statins, we do think, is from lowering inflammation.
All right. Anything dietary or exercise-wise that would be a benefit?
Certainly you want to be on a heart healthy diet and do normal exercise. There are foods we think are anti-inflammatory, and really a Mediterranean type of diet where you're eating a lot of fruits, vegetables, olive oil, things like that, I would recommend.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, welcoming Dr. Patrick McNulty to Saratoga Hospital's Medical Group's cardiology practice as the new director of interventional cardiology at Saratoga Hospital, saratogahospital.org. Seniors Helping Seniors, offering retired seniors an opportunity to help local seniors to live independently at home, 413-822-9988. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients, with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. And from Curtis Lumber, featuring Great American Kitchen, Wellborn Cabinets, and Cambria Quartz Countertops, 100% American-made products by American workers, sold locally by Curtis Lumber. CurtisLumber.com.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. Appreciate your putting the whole thing back over here. We'll go to Sally in Bennington. All right, Sally in Bennington, you're on.
Hi. Something just stung. Am I on the phone? Or
yeah, no, you're on the air.
All right, there's a strange noise. I'm calling about my mom, who's 92 years old, almost 93, doing really well, but was diagnosed with congestive heart failure a number of years ago. And recently she's been having a very loose-sounding, juicy cough that I don't think is related to a virus or allergies, and I'm wondering if that's a symptom of congestive heart failure, and if it's a sign that we should take her to her heart doctor right away and make sure her medicines are correct, or...
Yep. Coughing can be a sign of heart failure. Again, that fluid increase in the lungs, usually it wouldn't be a productive cough. It would typically be a dry cough, that nothing really would come up with the cough. Oftentimes we will see if she lies down, if she lies flat and she's more short of breath or coughing more, the fluid's layering out. So that's something to consider. But if it doesn't seem like an infection or allergies, that is a consideration. She may need a chest x-ray. We have blood tests called BNP that can measure fluid levels in your system. So there's a lot of ways to diagnose it, or just listening to her lungs and seeing if there's crackling. But yeah, if it doesn't seem to be one of the other causes, it may be worth certainly having her see her physician.
Yeah, I think maybe she does exercise twice a week with a class, and she's been really active, and this is sort of a new development. So I'm wondering if we should get back to the heart doctor. I don't think he sees her on a very regular basis.
I agree.
Okay,
yeah,
Sally.
Okay.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye.
Bye. Okay, we'll go to Philip in Amsterdam. All right, Philip, your turn.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I have a knee that has to be reconstructed, and it's been probably by the end of July. But meanwhile, I'm in a lot of pain walking around. I take aspirin to take care of the pain, but aspirin has the undesirable side effect of making me constipated. Do you have a painkiller that would stop that problem?
I must say we use aspirin quite liberally. I don't see constipation as a side effect normally of that. I would ask your physician if ibuprofen or another non-steroidal medication would be good. You certainly want to steer clear of any type of narcotic because that's going to really constipate you. But typically aspirin would not constipate you. It does thin the blood, and we worry about GI bleeding with aspirin, but it typically doesn't cause constipation for most people.
Okay, well... It seems like it's on and off for me. You know, I take it, it's on, it's top, it's off. But thank you very much.
Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. Only two people waiting right now. If you want to get in, this is the time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. Joe in Plattekill. All right, Joe, you are now on. Okay, can you hear me, Joe?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay,
good
get
afternoon,
close.
Doctors.
Get close to the phone.
I had a stroke 2 years ago, and it was a shot out of blue because I was in very good physical shape. So they did all kinds of tests on me, and they said my arteries looked fine. But of course, they put me on Plavix and something for cholesterol. But one of the things they discovered was that they said I had a PFO. and you know, so that's a hole, you know, the hole in the heart.
Yep. So a PFO is a patent foramen ovale. So the foramen ovale is a connection between the atria that everybody has in utero, and then it's normally closed, although sometimes it doesn't close. So there's a lot of times we will do the echocardiograms that we spoke about, and we will see a patent foramen ovale, which you can actually see flow going in between the atria. So it's one of those true and unrelated possibly scenarios where you have the hole. We're still not certain that's the cause of a stroke, but if there's no other etiology, that may be. My understanding is if you were taking some type of blood thinner already and had the stroke with the PFO, that's an indication to close it. If you were not on a blood thinner like Plavix and now you're taking it, you may not need it closed. But those can be closed with a closure device, which would seal the hole. But when they looked at it with trials compared to blood thinners, the blood thinners may be adequate for you.
Okay, yeah, because I was questioning the wisdom of whether or not to close it. They told me they weren't going to close it again unless I had another stroke. I kind of found that a little incredulous because I thought, you know, if I have another stroke, I might not live.
Well, it's true. If you're now that you're on the blood thinners, if you had another stroke, that certainly would be the indication. But when they did look at closing it versus just the anti-clotting medicines, there didn't seem to be a benefit. So I think they're doing the proper thing.
Well, all right.
Yeah. Go
ahead. Hello. Whoops. Well, Easy come, easy go, I always say. All right, we'll go to Henry in Woodstock, number four. All right, Henry in Woodstock, you're on.
Hello?
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 Are you there, Henry?
Hello?
Hello?
I can hear you.
I can hear you.
Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay. I am interested in two tests for endothelial dysfunction. One, I believe, is called the EndoPat test, endothelia patency. And the other is the MPO test. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right. Myeloperoxidase.
Myeloperoxidase.
Both of which are supposed to measure inflammation. And I wondered what you thought of them and where they're available.
I wouldn't say they are a typical test that we would order. Is there a reason that you were wanted to have them done, or?
Well, yes, in the sense that my cholesterol is fairly high, but my blood pressure is very normal and comfortable. All sorts of other symptoms don't indicate anything bad, and my impression was that this would definitively describe the health of my arterial health.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that. I don't think those tests they're still more of a research niche. They're not certainly tried and true or everyday tests that people order. For inflammation in someone like yourself, a C-reactive protein, the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, is very inexpensive test, and it does measure inflammation.
That doesn't show anything. I mean, that seems normal.
That has been studied with cholesterol and statins and showing that there's risk. So if that's normal, I would say your chances of significant inflammation are small. So that would be reassuring.
So, in other words, you're saying these tests are really unnecessary and they're really prototypical at this point.
I don't order them. I'm not familiar enough to really say they're not helpful at all, but I don't think they're widespread use or there's not a lot of data or studies with them to know what it means with the results.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, Henry, thank you very much. All right. Now we're going to go to Jay in Woodstock. All right. Jay, you're on. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I'm in my 60s. I'm a marathon runner and very healthy. I take two supplements. I take glucosamine chondroitin and omega fish oils. Recently, last week, my doctor said I should start a baby aspirin regimen with the omega fish oils and the baby aspirin. Is that too much?
They really work differently. There is a little bit of blood thinning effect from the fish oils or omega-3 fatty acids. It's really a controversial topic as far as who should take aspirin for primary prevention. You know, obviously all of our patients who have heart disease are on aspirin because they've already had an event. But if you've never had anything, you have to weigh the risk of a slight increased risk of bleeding with the aspirin. There's a slight increased risk of intracranial bleeding, especially with aspirin. So it's really a debatable thing when people should start or if they should start it. It should be really based on risk factors. If you have a strong family history of heart disease or other risk factors, we go more in favor of it. But it's not for everybody because there's no free lunches there. So
the baby aspirin, which many of us take, the downside is bleeding, internal bleeding potentially.
Yes, and a slight increased risk of intracranial bleeding, uh-huh. which is devastating. So it's small. Certainly, the older you get, and if you have risk factors, we do favor giving it. But people come in younger and want to start taking it. We get nervous because there does increase the risk for bleeding.
Gotcha. Thank you very much. Okay. Now we're going to go to Rod in East Nassau. All right, Rod in East Nassau, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? I'm 65. I'm in good shape. I have good blood pressure levels. I do have vasovagal syndrome. I would just say.
Hey, Rod, are you close? Rod, are you close to the microphone? Because we're having some trouble.
I'm in
my car.
Right.
Can you hear me now? Should I be a little louder?
Yeah, the louder the better. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm 65. I don't take anything, and I'm in good shape. But every now and then, I get a flutter in my chest. I was born with a heart murmur, but is that how concerned should I be? Because every time I go to the doctor, she says I'm in great shape.
I think I would like to make a diagnosis of what exactly you're feeling. Usually that fluttering is some type of an irregular heartbeat. Most of the time it's benign. Certainly if it's very short-lived, it's usually not a dangerous thing. But it would be nice to know what is it. We have what we call Holter monitors, which are a 24-hour monitor that you wear at home and you go and do your normal routines. They have longer monitors people can wear for up to a month at a time and take on and off. But I would like to see what exactly you're feeling when you had the flutter, and then they would be able to tell you what irregular beat it is. It's usually some type of an irregular heartbeat. And again, mostly benign, but if it was atrial fibrillation or something like that, you would want to know what it is. So that might be worth doing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rod. All right. Now we'll go to, Nick and Saugerties. All right. Nick and Saugerties, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. And I have a couple questions about my father passed away early of cardiac arrhythmia, and now I'm approaching his age that he passed away at. And besides being healthy and exercising and eating right, is there any tests that I can go about to kind of see if I know he had... I'm pretty sure he had undiagnosed sleep apnea, and I actually had the sleep apnea surgery, and thankfully that went well, and it seems to have solved the problem. But other than kind of doing good preventative stuff, is there any kind of testing I can ask a doctor about to see what my chances are of kind of having a catastrophic heart failure?
Well, an arrhythmia, again, is an irregular heart rhythm, so that mm-hmm. also is kind of a generalized topic, could be a lot of different irregular type of beats, so it would be helpful if there was more information what kind of an arrhythmia it was. Sleep apnea...
Well, I unfortunately don't know. That was just kind of his autopsy report was posted as that okay. cardiac arrhythmia. He had nothing, ever diagnosed as... prior to that, it was just his heart stopped one day.
So we have the sleep apnea definitely can cause arrhythmias, so that's good that you had that fixed, because we do see a lot of patients with sleep apnea who have irregular heart rhythms. But basically, for irregular heartbeats, if your heart is structurally normal, then we don't worry as much. Our patients who've had heart attacks and they're having irregular heart rhythms, we worry a lot more, because then they portend a more of a problem. So if your heart is structurally normal, the arrhythmia should have a lessened risk. I would say an EKG, just a 12-lead EKG, could look at, for some basic arrhythmias, we can look at the QT interval, which is a measurement on your EKG that sometimes can indicate risk for arrhythmias. And that's a cheap, easy test, just a 12-lead EKG, and can get some good measurements there. But if your heart is in good shape from what it sounds like you're trying to be healthy, the arrhythmia risks are usually lower.
Okay. All right.
Thanks a lot.
I was just wondering if there was anything I could do besides make sure my life insurance policy.
I would get that EKG and have a cardiologist look at it, and that would at least give you a baseline. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. We'll go now to Nancy in Rosendale. All right, Nancy, your turn.
Hi, this is Nancy. My father died at the age of 64 from a dissected aorta, and I had always had a concern that he had a lot of symptoms of Marfan syndrome. He was over 6'4". He was nearsighted. He had narrow shoulders with not a greatly developed chest, long fingers. And now my nephew is over, he also had a heart murmur. when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
My nephew is over 6'7", and had a heart murmur as a child. Is there any way that I should recommend to him any kind of investigation by his doctor that this might be a problem?
That's a terrific question. There's clearly a major relationship between Marfan syndrome and aortic dissection. So basically with Marfan's, you know, the aortic root, the beginning part of the aorta gets dilated, and there's a weakness, a genetic weakness in the walls of the artery that can have it tear, which is the dissection, and that's a bad thing to happen. So as a screening test, what we would do is an echocardiogram, which we've talked about before, the ultrasounds of the heart. You can see that beginning part of the aorta very well, and you could tell if that's enlarged or not. So there's different criteria if you had Marfan syndrome versus if you did not, whether you would intervene. Now, people who have known Marfan syndrome and have an enlarged aorta, even if they're asymptomatic, they would have surgery to correct that because you don't want to have the dissection. But Marfan's is a genetic diagnosis. Obviously, you can tell phenotypically if the tall and the long fingers and things like that. But it would be nice to know if that was truly Marfan's, because that can be genetically tested for other members of the family to see if you have that gene. Some people can have the gene and not really have that appearance so much. But if there is a concern of Marfan's, you know, that ultrasound is an easy test and can look at the aorta and see if there's an issue.
Okay, and would his doctor know how to do genetic testing the gene?
You know, they would have to. Usually, we would refer to a genetic counselor or a genetic specialist, because it's not something you can just send someone to the lab for that. It really has to go through a genetic person. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, since my father passed away, there's no way to test now whether he had the gene or not.
Well, it would be difficult. You'd have to, you know, exhume.
Yeah, he was never formally diagnosed, but I just, you know, my brother thinks that I'm like crazy about this, and I'm thinking it just seems maybe worth checking out.
Okay,
Nancy,
I agree.
I'm so sorry we got to let you go, because we got up against the break here.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Take it away, Zach.
Support comes from Gear Village, a senior community where one can age in a supportive environment at all stages of life. GearVillage.com for information. Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now offering dialysis. NLH.org. Clipcentric Albany, a local video services division of Clipcentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV. Albany.clipcentric.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. And from the New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Services, offering assistance via a new website, nysba.org/lawyer-referral.
And we are rounding the horn for the third section of this program with Dr. Scott Rogge, medical director of cardiology at Southwestern Vermont Healthcare. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have some people on the phone. We're going to try to get everybody in that we possibly can. Let's go now to Marianne. Okay, Marianne, you're on.
Hi. I recently heard that people with certain blood types may be more prone to heart failure, and the O type is different from the A and B, but I'm not sure just whether it's more prone or less prone.
I've not seen
anything on that.
I have not seen any data on that, Marianne, that there's a higher risk for a specific blood type for heart failure.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
I'm not aware.
All
right.
Thanks a lot, Marianne. Good for you. Let's go to, let's see here, Mary in Highland Falls. Okay, Mary in Highland Falls, your turn.
Hi, how are you? I'm one of those people that can't take statins. I mean, there's one statin I can take, and which is Livalo.
Uh-huh.
which I'm having an argument with my insurance company over. They don't want to pay for it. But I've tried every one other than that, and I get very pretty bad side effects. I try to be a good soldier and stay through them, but never seems to work. Is there anything, if I can't get back on the Livelo, is there any other treatments coming down the pike for high cholesterol?
So, yeah, you are not alone. I would say every day in my office I see multiple patients complaining of muscle aches and pains from statins, and I think it's real. We check a muscle level in the bloodstream to see if it's actually injuring the muscle, and sometimes that's elevated, sometimes it's not, but I'm convinced it's a real thing. To answer your question, the new, you probably read or heard about, they're called PCSK9 inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually a monoclonal antibody that works on the receptors, the cholesterol receptors in the liver. There was just a study presented recently that they do decrease cardiac events. They didn't prolong life or reduce mortality, but did reduce heart attacks and hospitalizations. So those medications are available. They are you have to give yourself an injection. So it's not a pill. It's an injection that you give every few weeks. They work incredibly well. They drop your bad cholesterol like in half. And it's unclear where they will really fall as far as with statins. But it's nice to have an alternative. And
well,
I have a few patients on them.
Why would that Livelo seems to work? What is the difference between that for other patients who might be listening, between that and then the other statins like Zocor and Pravacol?
It's kind of dependent on their specificity. Like atorvastatin or Lipitor, Zocor, simvastatin they're not as specific. They're more just the way the volume of distribution is. They affect more of the body, so they clearly have higher incidence of causing muscle pains than others. I think the Livelo is one of the lower ones, and other patients. So I mean, if you talk to your insurance company and say you've tried these and this is the only one works, but I know they still don't want
that's what we're in the process of doing now. So hopefully, I won't have to worry about taking an injection.
Yeah, I mean, but those
wonder why that works and the others don't. It's just kind of fascinating.
But they're all statins, but they're all different, and it's not uncommon that some people can take one and not others, and lower doses, and sometimes you have to take a little holiday from the medicine and restart it. But you're not alone. There's so many people that have the same problem.
Thank you, doctor.
So what class of medicine is Zetia?
Zetia is not a statin. It's not a PCSK9. It actually inhibits absorption of cholesterol.
Yeah.
So it blocks it that way. Side effects are very minimal. It's not as potent as the statins, but I have a lot of people on Zetia who can't take statins.
But the wrap on Zetia, right, is that are there not fewer events? Is that what happens?
Well, it didn't reduce mortality, but there was a study where it did improve
events.
Events, correct.
Yeah, interesting.
So I think it's a reasonable medicine.
Right. Let's see here. Oh, yeah. Patricia's been waiting a long time. Patricia in Woodstock. Hello, Patricia.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. This is not too complicated of a question, but I really appreciate being able to ask. My father's 98. He'll be 99 in August, and he has congestive heart failure. And recently he just started about 6 months ago a diuretic, furosemide.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to need more of it. But what's happening is his blood pressure is getting very low. He takes 120 milligrams of diltiazem, time release, and he takes either 20 or 40 milligrams a day of furosemide. And when he seems to get to the point where his pants aren't fitting, we give him the 40, and when he's doing better, we give him 20, and we just can't seem to get a balance. He gets very low readings when he's on the 40, but he seems to need it.
Yeah, that's a difficult dilemma. You know, the weights, I think, is another way to look. If his weight is going up and he's eating the same, that may be that he's needing more of the diuretics. But you're absolutely right. It drops your blood pressure like the other medications. You know, it's what we mentioned before, the systolic heart failure versus the diastolic heart failure. If it's systolic heart failure where his muscle is weakened, then we like to have him take certain medications that actually can improve the pumping. If we can improve the pumping, then he would need less of the water pill. So that's the way that we try to approach things. But absolutely, the heart medications all lower your pressure. The diuretics lower it. I think you're doing the right thing. You have to juggle it sometimes. But if his weight is going up or he's more swollen, more short of breath, he needs that higher dose of the fluid pill.
And let me just say, Patricia, I hope when I'm 99, if I ever get to be 99, my daughter will be as good to me as you are to your father.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind.
Okay.
Find out if it's the systolic heart failure or the diastolic? Would it have something to do with his readings? Because he has very odd blood pressure readings.
It would be the ultrasound, the echocardiogram would be able to tell if the pumping strength is normal or if it's low. So that would be the way to tell, you know, what kind of heart failure it is.
I see. Okay. And he also has AFib.
Yep. And the diltiazem, diltiazem may be helping with that to keep the rate down. So, again, it's a balancing act between one thing would be to take maybe the diltiazem at bedtime so it's not lowering his pressure as much as during the mornings. That's a trick.
Ah.
We do that sometimes to help, you know, be able to get the medications in, because when you're laying down, you're sleeping, the worst effects of the medicines are over. So,
okay, Patricia, thank you. Okay, we'll go to Sheila in Saugerties. All right, Sheila, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. About 2 years ago, my husband had a routine physical, and they found a heart murmur. So he went to a cardiologist, and he had some tests done, and the cardiologist told him that he needed a mitral valve replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was around May or June, and he said that he had to have it before the end of the summer. So we thought we should get a second opinion. So he got a second opinion from another cardiologist who said, and that was over 2 years ago, and the second cardiologist said that unless he had symptoms, he didn't have to have the mitral valve replacement, that he wasn't in danger of having a heart attack. He would just at some point start feeling worse, and if he started feeling worse, he should come in. He goes routinely, I think, every 3 months for an echocardiogram. I just wondered, you know, it's sort of hard to know who to believe in something like that, and just wanted to make sure we're doing what's right.
Yeah, no, that's also a great question. It may not hurt to get a third opinion, you know, a tiebreaker. You know, as we mentioned before, that mitral valve replacement is a little bit more of a tricky decision, because if you wait sometimes until they're symptomatic, the heart can enlarge and you don't want to wait that long. So that mitral regurgitation, there's specific signs, like with the ultrasounds, if it's enlarging your heart or damaging the heart in any way, you don't want to wait. Even if you're feeling well, you want to fix that. So maybe a third opinion, but there's certainly, it's reasonable to fix that specific valve, even if you feel well, if there's indications that it's doing some bad things to the heart.
I think he said that it's only good for 10 years, so that was also, you know, an issue too.
The mitral valve sometimes can be repaired, so that would be something to at least ask. If they can fix your own valve and they can work on the leaflets themselves and repair it, that would be the ideal. The other kinds of valves, like there's mechanical valves which last forever, but you have to take blood thinners, and then there's the bioprosthetic valves that you have to, 10, 15 years can start to wear out.
Thank you, Sheila. Okay, now we'll go to Deborah in West Glenville. All right, Deborah, you're on.
Hi, I have a lot of issues. I'm 60 years old. I have sleep apnea. My history is my mom has a pacemaker. She got it at 82. My dad had a massive deadly heart attack at 42, and his parents did in their early 50s. I now have symptoms which are like fluttering, sometimes squeezing in my heart. When I lie on my left side, it hurts. It's hurt since I was in my 20s. It doesn't hurt. My heart doesn't hurt when I lie on my right side. I also take fish oil. I have high cholesterol. And sometimes even the pain is sharp. I've had some heart tests through my regular practitioner, like EKG.
Mm-hmm.
And, different ones. And I even had a heart monitor recently. And they said everything seemed fine. But there was no way to really describe what was going on. You know, there was no place to type in. There were some times that my head felt like there was some kind of obstruction in the veins in there, like I was going to pass out. I've had a few concussions. But anyway, like I said, I have a cacophony of things going on. But I'm going to a cardiologist in about 3 or 4 weeks. It took a while to get the appointment. And so I'll talk with that person. But do you have any knowledge of what it could be if you sleep on your left side and it hurts?
That's not a typical symptom that I would say would be from a blocked artery or something like that. It usually wouldn't come like that. It would be discomfort more if you were exerting, or the more energy the heart needed, then there would be discomfort. It's usually not a sign or a symptom when you lay on a certain side for it to hurt. So having said that, you know,
just because it's the left. Go ahead.
Having said that, the pressure, you know, if you said you noticed some pressure and things like that, you have risk factors, you have family history and cholesterol. I think your cardiologist will probably do a stress test, which would be reasonable.
Well, I've had two stress tests in my life, and each time I was getting close to a heart attack, and I refused to go all the way to the heart attack. And I told them that, I'm sorry, I'm not doing that, so you can test me. And but really, I do get winded when I exert, and that's why I've gained weight, because I don't exert myself as much. And it's kind of a syndrome in a way, because then my thyroid starts to act. I'm hypothyroid now, so
there's other kinds of stress tests that are, we call pharmacologic stress tests, that you don't have to run on the treadmill. There's a lot of people who can't run on a treadmill or get their heart rate up. So there's other ways to do that, those kinds of tests, and make sure the heart's okay.
So, Deborah, I'm so sorry, but we have to let you go because we're trying to get everybody in here. Thanks again for your call. All right, let's go to, Beverly in Hinsdale. Okay, Beverly in Hinsdale, your turn. Go.
Hi. My husband had a stroke about 5 weeks ago, and while he was in the hospital, he was diagnosed with AFib, and they put a link implant in. And I have two questions. One, they want to do an ablation procedure, which I know very little about. And also, he was on Adderall for a very long time, and I was wondering if there was long-term effects on being on Adderall. They took him off of that because it was raising his blood pressure.
Yeah, I mean, the Adderall, as you know, is a stimulant. It can cause the heart to race. As far as the ablation, was he having other symptoms, or were they just had the stroke? Was he feeling palpitations, or?
Yeah, he's got AFib.
Right, but did he feel the AFib? Did he have other?
He can feel it every once in a while, and with the link implant that he has, he's got like a little monitor with his keychain, and when he feels it, he has to put that up to his chest so they can.
Right.
Mark that one that he feels.
So the ablation, basically, they go in through the veins in your leg up into the heart, and they use radio frequency to ablate around the pulmonary veins. The pulmonary veins are kind of where the AFib starts in people's hearts. So that's a very common procedure that we send people for with AFib. But, usually you try different kinds of medications first and use the ablation more as a secondary or third line tool. But if you've exhausted the medication, it's a very reasonable way to restore a normal rhythm and keep you hopefully in a normal rhythm.
So is the ablation procedure pretty, is it accurate? I mean, you don't have to go back in and have that redone?
They say 70% success rate. So I think that's a reasonable guide. That people do have to come back in and have it a second time. But it's for people, especially who are having side effects from the medications for AFib, it can be extremely helpful because they can oftentimes get off a lot of the medications. But it's a big deal. I mean, I don't want to, it's a big procedure to go through.
Thank you very much. Listen, here's our problem. We're almost out of time. We are out of time. But Paula sent in from Woodstock and said that she was in New Zealand. She went to the ER. She had atrial flutter. And she did not have a heart attack. But her blood work is fine now. She thought that the flutter occurred due to jet lag and lack of sleep. Is that possible?
You know, it's a possibility because those sleep apnea patients who sleep poorly, they have a lot of atrial fibrillation. So I do think sleep has something to do with atrial fibrillation.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much, everybody. We left Sally on the line, Janice on the line. We apologize for that. And now we are out of time. I want to thank Dr. Scott Rogge of Southwestern Vermont Healthcare for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes the Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing, focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addiction. Villa Veritas. .org for inquiries. And thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.